On October the 14th then, 1956, Dr. Ambedkar began that mission to bring the Dhamma to the world. He went for refuge to the Three Jewels, he took the five precepts, and 400,000 people followed him. I've already told you what a momentous event that was, and I've also tried to show you something of the reasons and something of the journey to that great event. What I haven't told you is that the conversion, the great mass conversion in Nagpur, was threatened at the last minute. It was threatened by the government of India. The government of India, led by Jawaharlal Nehru, had instituted quotas or reservations for jobs for people who were formerly designated untouchables, the backward classes. When the government of India heard that the conversion was going ahead, it announced that these quotas would not be available to people who became Buddhist. Even though these people, in becoming Buddhist, there was no material improvement, they'd been exactly the same condition, the government was in effect penalising people for becoming Buddhists. There were also some elections coming up, and some of Dr. Ambedkar's leading followers thought that the conversion should be delayed because it might affect their chances of election. Dr. Ambedkar would have none of this. He was terribly disappointed that his, you know, leading followers could suggest such a thing. And in his great speech on the occasion of the mass conversion, he addressed these issues. It's a wonderful speech, full of passion, very direct, speaking from the heart to the heart. And he said, yes, I will do what I can. I will go to the courts. I will work to win those reservations back. He had no doubt about doing that. And they were, in the end, won back. But in the course of that speech, he looked at the whole question of the conversion movement and material gain. And I'm going to quote a longish passage, and it will give you some idea of how he could speak sometimes. Self-respect is more important than material gain. Our struggle is for honour, for self-respect, not for economic progress alone. There is a locality in Bombay where prostitutes live. These women who sell their bodies wake up late in the morning and call for the Muslim boys who work in the restaurants located in the Mohalla. "O Suleiman, O Suleiman," they shout out, "bring some meat, curry and naan." These women take meat, curry and naan and tea every day. Many of the women present here do not even get a square meal every day. They have to content themselves with country chapati and groundnut chutney. If they wanted, they could get rich through selling their bodies, but they care more for their honour, for their dignity and self-respect. This is what we're all struggling for honour and self-respect. What Dr. Ambedkar was doing here was comparing those of his followers, and they were his wealthy and powerful followers, actually, who were prepared to not to convert for fear of material loss, to the prostitutes of central Bombay. Then he said, "Those who wish to go for refuge to Bhagwan Buddha must do so after counting the cost, for it is a religion very difficult to practice." Wonderful phrase, that. Those who wish to go for refuge to Bhagwan Buddha must do so after counting the cost, for it is a religion very difficult to practice. And that stands for everybody who would wish to be a Buddhist. To be a Buddhist involves renunciation. It involves sacrifice, even. If you want to change, if you want to bring about that revolution in yourself and in the world, you have to go forth. Dr. Ambedkar knew that. He knew it involved renunciation and even sacrifice. He knew that because he lived it. His whole life, in fact, was a life completely devoted to the improvement of the downtrodden. It took a great toll on his health. 7 weeks after the mass conversion, he died. And he was working right up until the last minute. He was working on the Buddha and his Dhamma, his great work. Dr. Ambedkar led a life of the most extraordinary selflessness. And I have no doubt that he was a bodhisattva. His life was dedicated to bringing light to a realm of thick darkness. It was a life devoted to liberating people from hell, from the prison of untouchability. His struggle brought him to the Dhamma, and what he initiated was a Dhamma revolution. That revolution continues to this day, mainly in India, mainly, I think, I can say, through the work of the TBMSG, Trailokya Baldhamar Sangha Sayakana, through the work of order members, mitras and friends, inspired not just by Dr. Ambedkar, but by our own teacher, Bhante Sangharakshita, by Lokamitra and others. But the Dhamma revolution has to spread more widely. There's still much work to do in India. There are still people who suffer through discrimination, inequality and poverty. Atrocities are still committed against the Dalits, the downtrodden. Not a day goes by where you pick up a paper and you'll find some reference to that. And the Dhamma revolution is needed not only in India, it's needed not just in the East, it's needed here in the West. More than ever. We live in very strange times. We live in times where there's extraordinary material improvement, but there seems to me an increasingly terrible emptiness at the heart of Western society, almost because of that increased materiality. And because of that, there are very deep tensions within our society which explode into conflict. You know, we see it, it happens in Britain. We saw it throughout the summer, we know that. Recent events show us just how much hatred there is in the world and how terrible the effects of that hatred is. We need a Dhamma revolution, a truly human revolution, a revolution of love. It won't be easy. It will take a very long time. It will take a lot of sacrifice. But a Dhamma revolution is the revolution we need. May we all play our part in the Dhamma revolution. Thank you.